My name is Michelle. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been given the privilege of introducing our guest speaker for the Vicky Paw Convention 2012. I guess the most obvious question is, how does Vicky Paw go about picking a speaker? The committee members are encouraged to submit speakers for consideration by the entire committee. It may be someone we know personally, someone from a tape, or in this case, someone from the XA site online. Speakers are narrowed down to about two or three speakers, and after many emails and discussions by the committee, it is an AA committee after all, we finally vote. This year we considered age, length of sobriety, gender, and the overall message of the speaker's share. Our decision is truly an example of God doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. There was a serendipitous call from Australia to a small church in a small town in Pennsylvania, USA, where the pastor of that church actually took the call, who knew our speaker's sponsor, and called that woman, who then got in touch with our speaker. And as it happens, she's here today. She's been sober for over 17 years. She's still in her 30s. She's a married mother of four children, ranging in ages from 3 to 16. She lives in rural Pennsylvania on a mountaintop, and bears in her backyard are a regular and rather normal occurrence. True story. We're very lucky and honored to have her as our guest speaker this weekend. Please help me give a warm welcome to Vicky Paw 2012's guest speaker, Carrie C.
Hi, my name is Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 6, 1994. My home group is the Way Out Group in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. My sponsor's name is Peggy, so that's the woman who took the phone call from the pastor from Hamish. Anyway, I want to really thank you for having me here. I can't tell you how awesome it is to be in Australia. I mean, I think when an American thinks of like an exotic place, I mean, an exotic place where you're not going to get like a tropical disease or something, we think of Australia because like, you're going to get the benefit of, you know, having weird stuff and not having to, like, you know, get malaria or any shots or things like that. For us, you know, like, the idea of coming to Australia is like coming to a paradise, coming to a place where there's just, you're going to see things that you've never seen before. And, of course, you know, having grown up in America and in New Jersey, and I've seen gangsters, I've seen pollution, all kinds of interesting, wonderful things, but, you know, I think that when I think of something about, when I think of an untouched and a place that I think embodies adventure, I think it's Australia's the epitome of this. So what I didn't do is when I was invited to come here, like, I didn't Google Melbourne, or Melbourne, sorry. I pronounce my R's. I didn't Google it. I didn't do anything. I just said, Australia? Hell yeah. I'm so coming. When I got here, I really didn't know what to expect. And what I find in AA all over the world, which is wonderful people, welcoming arms, a feeling of being at home. What amazes me amongst our fellowship is that I can go anywhere in the world and I can feel like I am a part of something greater. I can feel like I'm not alone. You know, I'm a single woman and I'm traveling not even halfway across the world, across the world. And coming to a strange country with weird things and, you know, spiders that bite you and make your arm rot off. And I had a moment of panic. I said, oh my God, what am I doing? And then I said, you know, I put out my hand and I said, God, take my hand and we're going to do this. You know, because it gets like, well, what if I miss my connection? I have to sit 16 hours on a plane. You know, this is the craziness. But I landed and I just felt surrounded by love. And when we talk about the fellowship of the spirit, you know, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that sense of belonging and that sense of knowing somebody. We know who each other are without having to open our mouths. By virtue of saying that, hi, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic, you know exactly who I am, and you know exactly why I'm here. And that is the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have this common ground that I don't think many people in the world truly understand. Because to be an alcoholic is to have this incredible experience. To be sober and alcoholic is to... For an alcoholic to draw a sober breath is a miracle. Because alcoholics, we don't get sober. We drink and we die. That's what we do. Because we had, you know, we had that presentation over there about the deadly disease. We die 3.5 times more than the average person. And God's honest truth is not, it's actually more than that. Because there are so many deaths that occur that are attributed, alcohol is a contributing factor, but it isn't designated as an alcohol-related death. So, and I think about that. And I think about the fact that I've been drawing a sober breath for 17 years. And that to me is beyond any possible comprehension, you know, because I should not be here. I should be dead. In fact, I was dead for 2.5 minutes. We'll get to that. But the fact is that I shouldn't stand here. By all rights, statistically, I shouldn't be here. But I am. And that, to me, is the most important embodiment. When we talk about, when we say, like, I want evidence that God exists or that there's a power greater than myself, you know, because I'm a pretty cynical person. And then I stop and I think, I have a deadly disease and I haven't died yet. And I haven't picked up, I haven't felt the need to pick up a drink for 17 years. So whatever little problem that I'm worrying about in my life, whatever little molehill that I'm making into the mountain, and I take a step back and go, oh, yeah. If God can, and AA and the principles of this program can help me, you know, surmount a disease that should have killed me by all means a long time ago, I think it can handle, you know, my nasty boss at work, you know. But I'm getting ahead of myself. What I want to do, and the whole point of this little talk tonight, is to get you guys to come to the Big Book studies tomorrow. You know, because that's where the solution is. That's where, like, having me talk tonight is to get you interested and say, what the hell did this girl do? How did she get sober at 18 years old? Why is it that, you know, this demented little girl that I'm about to explain is somehow turned into a sober woman who can actually use 3-syllable words? I don't carry knives anymore. Belinda gave me a key to her house. She left me alone in her flat. Like, that was something that didn't happen 17 years ago. You know, nobody ever, my mother showered with her purse. People didn't just say, you know, hey, just hang out at my house with my expensive stuff and don't steal it. Well, I mean, it was kind of hard getting her TV on a plane. But the point is that Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me into a person that can be trusted. And we all know that alcoholics, an active alcoholic, is the exact opposite of that. And, you know, the fact is that I didn't want to be somebody who wasn't trustworthy. I didn't want to be a liar. I didn't want to be a thief. I didn't want to hurt the people I hurt in my life. But the fact is that I was in an immense amount of pain myself, and I didn't know how to be any other way. We talk about alcoholism, and, you know, and for a long time, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't get sober. I came in at 13. I was one of those teenagers that was described in the doctor's opinion. Thank God my parents went to Al-Anon. They went to Al-Anon, so they learned to, like, put her in rehab over and over and over again. And and so I spent, like, my entire high school career in and out of rehab. In fact, I was, like, in high school, like, in rehabs, when you're an adolescent, they have, like, school and rehab. And I probably spent more time in the classroom in the adolescent ward of the local rehab than I did actually in my own high school. So, for me, I spent a lot of time in and around the fellowship with some of the best treatment in the world. My parents had wonderful insurance. I went to country club rehabs, like, where, you know, I rode horses and I swam and I made moccasins. I mean, I still have a belt I have from rehab. So I did lots of art therapy. I talked about my feelings. I had a lot of feelings. And I went to meetings, and this is what I did. I got boyfriends. I went to a lot of dances. Sometimes I made coffee. And for some reason, I just couldn't get sober, and I couldn't figure out why. And in that order, by the way. And this was a typical Carrie thing, is that I'd get in trouble. I'd do something incredibly stupid, like, you know, like rob my parents, and run away for a couple weeks, and steal all their jewelry, and then break into their house again, and get caught, because, like, who else is going to be breaking into the house and stealing the jewelry? But, you know, the alcoholic, who's, you know, just is not bright. Because I wasn't, like, a good thief either. I was a terrible thief. Like, you totally knew I did it. Because there'd be, like, the screwdriver would be still stuck in the door that I jimmied, you know. Only I would do something like that, right? So bottom line is, like, something like that would happen, and I would get in trouble. So what I would say is, okay, I'll go to rehab again, Mom. You know, because that's what you do. You go to rehab, you hang out, you pick up a couple boyfriends in the rehab. Because what I would do is I'd get there, and I would detox for a little bit, and I'd get sick, and I'd shake, and all terrible, you know. And after I stopped throwing up, I lost some weight, you know, because, you know, when you're throwing up and detoxing, you're not eating. So, like, then I'm all thin again, instead of being bloated from drinking all that, you know, that beer gut that you get. So then I'm feeling all good about myself. So I'm strutting around the ward, you know. And I'm thinking, okay, bipolar schizophrenic, pyromaniac, sex addict. There we go. In the bathroom. And as soon as he was released into the wild, I would just pick the next one. And so I would leave rehab with a string of boyfriends. You know, an agreement with my parents that I promised this time I'm going to go to AA and behave myself. And I would be drunk in a short period of time because I didn't really understand why I was there and I didn't really have any desire to change. What I wanted was to appease the people in my life and have the consequences stop. Because I didn't really understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. So I would come to meetings and I would say, hi, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know about the physical allergy, the abnormal reaction that alcoholics have. I didn't understand the spiritual malady and I didn't understand the mental obsession. What I understood was that, you know, I wanted to drink and people were getting in my way and annoying me. And that if I promised to go to AA, if I promised to do something about it, they would shut up. And that's pretty much what I understood the 12-step programs to be about. And I would go to AA and I would look around and there would be like, you know, 40-year-old men. And that's like it. And I was, you know, 15, 14, covered in tattoos. Homemade at that time, so I didn't even have the nice tattoos I have now. I'm kidding. I had, you know, I had purple and green hair, mohawk, you know, like spiked belt, Doc Martens, and I would stomp into these meetings with these old men and like one blue-haired old lady. And of course, that would end up being my sponsor because like, there's nobody else. There's like, you know, 30 men and one blue-haired lady. And I would think, I'm just going to die. There's no way that I can get sober. There's no way I can do this because I don't understand what this is about. And I don't understand why, you know, I can be in the hospital for 30 days, 90 days, and I can learn all this stuff and be in all these groups and talk about my feelings and all of that stuff and then come out and I just can't not drink. Because I didn't understand about the mental obsession. I didn't understand that I had a spiritual malady that needed to be treated. I didn't understand that alcoholism was a disease of the mind, the body, and the spirit, and it needed to be treated in exactly that way. We treat it in the body by abstinence. We stop drinking, right? An alcoholic can stop drinking, but we have difficulty staying stopped. I mean, that's the real crux of the issue with the alcoholic. I can put down the drink for a day, or two, you know, a week, but I inevitably go back to it. So the question is, why as an alcoholic do I continually go back to the very thing that's killing me? Well, there's two reasons. One is because I have a mind that tells me that this time is going to be different. I have a mind that tells me that somehow I deserve to drink because my life sucks, that, you know, that I'm entitled because the world owes me something. I have a mind that tells me that somehow this drink is going to fix my problem. What I basically have is I had this idea that if I can fix the stuff on the outside of my life, that somehow I can drink successfully. That it's not really me that's the problem, it's the circumstances of my life. And if I can, it's kind of like polishing the brass on the Titanic, you know? It's that I'm continually trying to fix the outside, and meanwhile the ship's going down, man. And I have no concept of this, because I think that if I could find the right boyfriend, and if I was just 2 inches taller, I was blonde, and my boobs were bigger, that everything would just be okay. Like, why is it, like, if I could just be that person, if I could just pretend to be somebody else and make myself believe it, maybe I don't have to drink this way. You ever feel like that? You know, and the problem with the alcoholic is we project that sense, not the, you know, 6-foot blonde thing, but I project that sense that, you know, somehow I'm different, like that I'm not a lying, cheating, manipulative, violent drunk that, you know, I'm a good girl and I behave myself and I'm intelligent and whatever that might be. And I project that sense to people. And at first they believe it because, you know, most people don't assume that you're lying. But what inevitably happens is that I start to become me again. And as I become me again, the people around me begin to see that that person that I pretended to be is not who I truly am. And they start to go, whoa, what the hell is that? And they back off. And then I feel rejected and alone. And what do? I go back to the bottle because it's the only thing that I know how to do. You know, so there's this continuous cycle of trying to be something that I wasn't, pretending that I was, and continually going back to the very thing that was killing me. And so the question is why did I feel like I had to be somebody else? Why is it that I felt so different than other people? I mean, I remember like my kindergarten report card used to say did not work and play well with others. Like I was the kid that like, you know, the teacher would give like a toy and sit in the corner and just be like, just don't talk. Just sit in the corner and just be quiet. Like I was forever in trouble. Like I had poor impulse control. And I wondered what, you know, like there was just something about me from the very beginning that was just very different. And I don't know if that's alcoholism per se, but I know a lot of alcoholics, we have these characteristics. And what I found in the big book, it talks about it. It says that, you know, that we're irritable, restless, and discontent till we can at once feel the ease and comfort which comes from taking a few drinks which we see other people taking with impunity or without consequence. So as an alcoholic, you know, when I'm not drinking, I'm a miserable bastard, essentially. And my main goal in life is to make everybody else as miserable as I am. You know, and so essentially, the way that I felt when I didn't have alcohol in my body is I didn't know where you ended and I began. And it was like I had no skin, you know, and I was a raw bundle of nerves. And I had no concept that of what was mine and what was yours, you know, including your stuff. But also, you know, things like, you know, your perceptions of me, your perceptions of yourself, like everything that happened in the world and to you was an extension of me. And I had no concept that, you know, that each person was an individual and they were entitled to feel how they wanted to feel and that was not a reflection on who I was as an individual. I had no concept of that. What I understood is if you didn't like me, I was nothing, I was no good, and I should die. And that was the exact, you know, domino effect that would happen is that somebody wouldn't like me and I'd feel like shit and, oh, excuse me, I'm really working on the cursing thing. I'm a foul-mouthed hooligan. I was a brat. I got sober a brat. I'm really working on it. And so one of the things I really try to do is work on my language, but I inevitably will curse this weekend. So I'm going to apologize in advance if I offend anybody with my bad mouth, but I am trying. So please bear with me. So needless to say, you know, I walked around with this sense that I was less than, that, you know, that there was something innately wrong with me. And what I've come to learn is that the spiritual malady, it talks about it in the big book, it says that we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. That we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate seemingly without provocation, but at some time in the past, I make a decision based on self that puts me in the position to be hurt, which is usually a decision based on fear. Because I'm afraid. I'm constantly afraid. I'm afraid of what you think. I'm afraid of what you don't think. I'm afraid of who I am, what you are, everything. And it's this constant committee screaming in my head all the time. Well, if your thoughts are going 1,000 miles a minute and you're thinking about what other people are thinking about, what they're thinking about, what you're thinking, and you're projecting these thoughts constantly on people and it's, you know, all the time, I'm reading your mind. And of course, I'm reading your mind wrong because I'm not bright. But I assume that everything that I think must be real. So if I think it's true, then it must be true and you're thinking it too. So I walk through my life looking at everybody having no ability to differentiate my own thoughts or feelings from reality. Everything I thought, everything I felt had to be true and real because I thought it and I felt it and therefore it was. And so I walk through my life with this. And of course, when you're walking around like that, I mean, a drink sounds like a really good idea now, doesn't it? So when we talk about alcoholism being mind, body, and spirit, and that when we straighten out spiritually, we straighten out mentally and physically, what we're talking about is saying that if we treat this spiritual problem, this spiritual malady, that something happens within us that we're easily able to control our desire for alcohol. And the mental obsession, you know, goes away, because alcohol doesn't look like a good idea anymore. I mean, it goes down to this thing, is that, you know, as an alcoholic, I sought relief. I sought relief through alcohol. I sought relief through what I call non-conference approved substances. Read between those lines. I sought relief through men. I sought relief through, you know, prestige. I sought relief through all of these things. And they never lasted, because they're human powers. And what I was told was that something more than a human power is needed for me to recover from alcoholism. And ultimately, what I needed to do was address that sense of loneliness and despair that was going on inside of me. And be honest, I didn't even know that I felt this way. I mean, I just went through my life like a constant whirlwind, reacting to everything and everyone. It was only after I had a spiritual experience and I really began to look at the way that I thought about the world that I began to realize how really demented I was. You know, it was only on retrospect that I began to really realize how driven I was by the things that I thought. Like, my thoughts just owned me all the time. So where did this, you know, crazy head bring me? Well, what it brought me, and this is, you know, the thing that I hope that hooks you to get you to come to the workshops tomorrow, is that, you know, I picked up a drink when I was 9 years old. By the time I was 13, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and rehab. By the time I was 16, I was dead for 2.5 minutes. The funny thing, and this is the interesting thing about my life always comes full circle. So when I was 15 years old, my parents, who recognized that there was really something wrong with their beautiful little daughter, you know, because she shaved her head and stuck things through her face and stole money and puked on the floor and did all those wonderful things, sent me to live at my sister's house in Pennsylvania, where I now live. And it was the first time in my life that I was actually not able to get alcohol in the way that I normally could. And what I found was that for that year, two things happened. I got really good grades, because apparently when you're not drunk, you can, like, learn stuff. But the other thing that happened was that I was overwhelmed by this sense of depression and anxiety that I didn't really know I had, because I just drank, man. I just drank all the time. I just drank, and that's what I did, and I did non-conference-approved things, and that's what I did. And so I never really had a chance to be separated for any extended period of time from alcohol, except for when I was in rehab, and I was certainly medicating with the sex addict, so I was good with that. So I didn't have a chance to really experience myself without alcohol or distraction. And in that year, I attempted suicide 3 times. And I died 1. And I was obviously resuscitated, and I'm sitting here now. Or standing here, sorry. But my point is that, you know, that's the experience that I had with alcohol. That's the experience I had with alcoholism, and that's the experience I had with this, what we call the spiritual malady. So what happened? Well, a couple years later, because this is again the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, and the way that, you know, I've found, and I've been talking to people, and the AA here is very different than the AA that I have, you know, we've had in the United States. In the United States, we really don't work a whole lot of steps. We really don't do the big book. In fact, I've been thrown out of meetings for talking about the big book. They've called me things like step Nazi, which, you know, I really haven't put anybody to death any time in the past 17 years, so I don't really like the comparison. Just saying. No. But, I mean, where I got sober, you know, it was very hostile to the 12 steps. So all I knew about AA was about the fellowship, because there, you know, there are 3 sides to that triangle. You know, and the only side of the triangle that I experienced was the fellowship. And the fellowship really wasn't cutting it for me. And for some people, they can come into the fellowship and meet some new friends and hang out and get some new shoes and a new dress, and they're feeling really good about themselves, maybe get some highlights, you know, and feel better, and a couple of years later maybe work a step or two and be all right. I'm not that kind of alcoholic, man. I'm a hopeless alcoholic. So what happens to me is I come in and I do all those things, and then I still drink. You know, so I spent a lot of time in AA just being miserable, sober or not. And what I found was God has an incredible sense of humor. So when I was 17 years old, I was sitting in a meeting. There was this really long-haired guy. He was gorgeous, with these beautiful blue eyes, freckles, the whole nine. He was 25, and, you know, he had just gotten out of prison. And I fell in love. So much so, I sat down next to him. My sponsor, like, took me by the ear and sat me in the corner and said, no, no, no. So what I did was I slept with him. Then I married him a couple years later. I met my husband in the meetings. And one of the other things that when they say, like, you really shouldn't, like, newcomers should probably not get involved together. They're kind of right on that. Because what happened was we started dating, then we started drinking, which was fun. But actually, that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me because I ran away from home when I was 17 again, like the, 300th time, but I actually left that time and I never went back. Knock wood. Love my parents, don't like living with them. So I ran away from home and I moved in with my ex-con, 25-year-old alcoholic who was sober 3 days. And we started drinking together, and I drank with utter abandon. I drank every day, nonstop, for 4 months, till I drank myself into DTs. In fact, I actually just thought I had the flu. Like, I used to talk about getting sober, and I was like, I got this terrible flu. Like, I got sober, and, like, I got really sick. And it was only, like, until when I was 5 years sober, my sponsor was like, yeah, that's called the DTs. I'm like, oh, I had DTs? Because, like, that's the denial of the alcoholic. It's like, I just had the flu, man. Because I've withdrawn off of non-conference-approved substances. But, you can't drink enough to withdraw off of alcohol. Well, yes, you can. But I was like, I was only 18. You can't get physically dependent upon alcohol. Well, yes, you can. And it turned out, like, all those times that I had flu when I went to, that was withdrawal. But that was something, that's the alcoholic mind that tells me that it's something different, So I drank with utter abandon, went through withdrawals, came back into AA, and my husband and I were like maybe 6 days sober and we found out we were pregnant with our first child. So I'm 18 years old, I'm homeless, I'm sleeping on people's couches in AA, because my family won't have anything to do with me, for good reason. And I have this child that I'm bringing into the world. And it was, to have my daughter was the best decision I ever made in my life, because I wouldn't be standing here if I didn't make that decision. Because I don't think it would have given me a reason to hold on. And it did. It gave me a reason to hold on until somebody was able to introduce me to the program of recovery. So I spent 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous dry. So dry that, I used to go to meetings and they used to call me Shaky Carrie because I would be so full with anxiety. I would walk with my cup of coffee and sit in the chair. By the time I got to my chair, I'd have coffee all over it. I'd have no coffee left. I'd have to go back and get it. Another cup. I couldn't speak to people. I couldn't look them in the eye. I could not function. I went from, being, a drunk and a thief to being completely incapable of interacting with human beings without alcohol. So I'm 2 years sober, and I have this beautiful daughter who's a year old. I have this wonderful husband who's sober. I have this great life, and I want to die again. And this crazy thing happened, and this is how everything in our life comes full circle. I told you I'm living in the house. I own the house that I killed myself in. Again, everything comes full circle. Life is strange that way. So, I go into this meeting in Staten Island, and there's this guy who's speaking. He's about to leave for India. He's going to study with the Dalai Lama. And it's this guy named Joe H. And, Joe H. kind of looks like if Captain Kangaroo and David Crosby had sex and had a love child, this is what this guy looked like. So I'm like a brat punk rock kid sitting in this meeting in Staten Island. And there's this Captain Kangaroo dude talking about the amends process and talking about how we have, how in the eighth step it says all, and we have to make amends to them, we have to be willing to make amends to them all. And I went up to him and I said, F you, buddy. Those people owe me amends. You don't know what life did to me. And my parents did this and this one did that. And I was molested and I was raped and I was this and I was that. And he just looked at me with that smile that I do. And I hated him. I wanted to kick him in his teeth. Because that smile, I totally have your number. You do it. You all do it to the newcomers when they come up saying crap like that. You all sit there with that smirk like, I still have you. You are mine. So he gives me that smile, and I have the urge to kick him in the teeth. But I don't. And he brings somebody over and he says, you know, you need to talk to this person. And they start talking to me about alcoholism. They start talking to me about the program of recovery. And they're talking about this thing, you know, program, fellowship, 12 steps. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, I read the step book. You know, I was like, when I do a 4-step one day, this is what I might do when I do it. And they're just laughing, you know, because I think I know everything. I have 2 years. I mean, I got it, right? I know what AA and recovery is all about. And they're just laughing their ass off at me because they totally know I'm delusional. They totally know that I'm just hanging on and I'm 1 millisecond, 1 breath away from dying an alcoholic death. You know, and slowly my walls came down because I began to see that something was going on with these people that was not going on with me. And so I know I talked about, and I don't really do war stories. I don't do that. Because, you know, if you want to know how to drink, if you're sitting in this room and you identify yourself as an alcoholic, you know how to drink. I don't need to tell you about the stupid shit I did. I don't need to tell you about the blowjobs. I don't need to tell you about those things. We've all, well, some of you. I know you did. We've all done stupid, disgusting, horrible things that make us cringe, right? We've all done them. You know, most of us. And the thing is that, you know, talking about those things, I mean, yeah, we identify they're funny and, you know, we definitely have that triage, dark sense of humor, you know, definitely. We have to. If you live our life, you have to have a freaking sense of humor. If you can't laugh at the stupid crap you did, you need to go home. You know, but you know, the idea here is this, is that you guys all know how to do that stupid shit. See, I did it again. I'm sorry. You all know how to do that stuff, but what I want to talk about is how we don't do those things. How don't I live my life run by fear? How do I show up every day? How do I live a life where people actually trust me, where they believe in me, where people ask me, they come up to me and say, you know, Carrie, I have a problem. Do you have an answer to that? And of course, I don't have the answer because I'm not bright, but I have a sponsor who does. You know, or I have a higher power that, you know, I have a sponsee call me up and they have this humongous problem. It's elaborate and they spend an hour explaining this to me, and they're like, so what do you think? I'm like, I don't know. Can I get back to you on that one? And then I'll be like washing the dishes or driving my kid to school, and I'll be like, oh yeah. And all of a sudden I'm like, I have an answer to that problem. Because God, I just asked, I said, God, you know, what the hell do I tell her? And then all of a sudden I go through my day and boom, the light comes on and I have an intuitive decision. I have an intuitive thing that happened and I absolutely know what to say, which usually pray, write a 4-step, make amends, you know, simple things. But I intuitively am able to draw these things out of me that I didn't even know I knew. And that's what we talk about when we talk about the fellowship of the Spirit. We talk about the love that binds alcoholics. The reason why I can get off a plane, you know, about 30 hours ago and feel like I'm at home. You know, because that thing, that common bond that we all have, we have a common peril and we have a common solution. The common peril being alcoholism, that stupid stuff that we do, that mind that tells us that we can drink, that spiritual malady that drives us to do incredibly stupid things drunk or sober. You know, we have that thing. We have that. We've been in that dark place. We've stared death in the eye. We all have. You don't come into Alcoholics Anonymous because you're having a good time. Nobody's having a good time when they come in here. Because, you know, if I was having a good time, I'd still be out there having a good time. I liked booze. It felt good. I really liked to do it. I would do it until, well, I would be doing it right now if it didn't do something to me and start sucking. You know, but the fact is at some point, drinking started to suck. And the benefits that I was getting out of alcohol were less than the consequences that I was getting from my drinking. And essentially, from a cost-benefit analysis, it cost me too much to continue to live the way I was living. And by some miracle, I was able to see that clearly enough to be able to grab a hold of the solution that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we have this common peril, common solution. We have having stared death in the face and recognizing that the path that I've been going on is going to inevitably lead me to die horribly. Because alcoholics, we do not go quietly into that good night. We go disgustingly. We implode, explode, and we're gross when we die. Have you ever, I mean, I'm sorry to say this, but I mean, have you ever watched somebody die from alcoholism? It's the most horrible thing in the world. I mean, we rot from the inside, literally. You know, so dying an alcoholic death is not pleasant, you know. And so the idea is we've all hit that moment. We've all had that moment if we're sitting here and stared death in the eye and said, you know, there's something else that I could be doing. You know, and that's the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. It offers me, it says, we can die an alcoholic death where I can live on a spiritual basis. It says that living on that spiritual basis is not an easy thing to do. But if I commit to this path, despite how scary, how difficult, how frightening it may be, by committing to this path, I can get something greater than anything that I could ever have possibly known. You know, and so we have this woman, and I'm wrapping it up. We have this woman here, you know, Meg, who had been institutionalized. I've been in 4-point restraints. By the way, you know, I used to make myself get into 4-point restraints. I would throw a fit on the floor in rehab so that they would shoot me up with drugs and then they tied me down because it was entertainment and I can get high. Yeah. So we had somebody who like intentionally got herself tied up and put in the rubber room because it was entertainment. So how can somebody who used to do that in their life become somebody who can raise 4 kids, who's had a successful marriage and married for 17 years, who actually finished high school, went to college, is now in graduate school? How does that happen? Well, it happens because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It happens because of these principles. There was a certain point in my life where I was presented with a dying an alcoholic death or living on a spiritual basis. And because somebody was able to present to me what a spiritual basis really looked like and what I needed to do it, I was able to grab a hold of that and continue. So what I really want you to think about, and what I hope will keep you in the big book studies tomorrow and steal you from the other meetings, is that, you know, there is a solution for this problem. And whether or not you're sober 2 days or 15 years or 30 years, there's always something that I could be doing that can bring me closer to God. Because there's always some area in my life where I'm playing God, you know, because I'm an alcoholic. You know, so the idea is that I can continue to evolve spiritually and grow. And there's always something for me to learn. And there's always, and so I try to be open to those opportunities. So I hope that this weekend will bring you closer to your higher power and help you to push away some of those things that might be interfering with your ability to be of maximum service to God and others. And I really want to thank you for having me, and thanks.